Hey, folks, and welcome to this week's podcast. It's Michael Shelley here, and our guest today is David Lowery. His new solo album, Fathers, Sons, and Brothers, is available May 30th, a 3-LP set or a double CD set or downloadable, of course. He's got a ton of gigs this summer. Some are solo, some are Cracker, some are Camper Van Beethoven, but he'll be through the South and the Midwest and the Far West, Colorado, Montana, California. So I assume they'll be adding, you know, we're not even close to the summer yet, and it's already a full summer, but check his different websites, David Lowery Music, Camper Van Beethoven, and CrackerSoul.com for information about all that various stuff. Interesting guy. It's also, I was trying to, talking to my wife, I was thinking, boy, how many folks have I interviewed that were older than me at the time I interviewed them? And the answer is most of them. I think David maybe is a little bit older than me, but he's basically my age. And it's kind of interesting to have an interview with somebody who's your age, who you went through the same thing, the same time they did anyway. Hope you enjoy this. It is me and David Lowery. Talk soon. All right, there is How Does Your Sister Roller Skate from Fathers, Sons, and Brothers, David Lowery's new album. David, good morning. Welcome to the program. How are you?
I'm pretty good. I'm about to, we have a big day today. There's a Camper Van Beethoven 40th anniversary show at the Fillmore tonight.
So. I know, sold out. Congratulations.
Well, thank you. Appreciate it.
So that is very typical of what this new album sounds like. You've sort of described it as an autobiographical album, sort of instead of writing a book, you just have been writing all these songs and this project sort of puts them all together. It's very unusual, yet it sort of sounds exactly like you. My first question is, are the people like your sister, you mentioned real people and people you have, family and friends and bandmates, is everyone happy to be mentioned in song?
Mostly, they are. There's a couple cases where I think some of them might rather not be mentioned. I'm thinking about my cousins who are in the song Super Bloom, and it's a story of them stealing a car. But in another way, I don't know. No, I'm surprised that nobody has really objected to most of this. And my sisters are all, I think it's hilarious that they're sort of mentioned in these songs. Mm. People who are mentioned in the songs have generally enjoyed having their stories told. But, you know, listen, this is as it sort of gets, you know, wider exposure. We haven't really had this, like, the whole thing released to the public yet. So it's possible somebody's going to come out of the woodwork and not be happy about the portrayal. But most of the portrayals are quite nice. I mean, most of it's about other people and how they were, you know, important in my life, or how they got to where, you know, what their roles were in sort of the bands and what they did and how important they were to me. So largely most of it's flattering. So I don't think anybody should object.
Yeah, I agree. It's kind of a very sweet sort of reminiscence on goofy events sometimes, or events that are emotional. I didn't mention that the whole record comes out on May 30th, so maybe the stuff will hit the fan after that. So you mentioned tonight at the Fillmore and tomorrow as well, Camper Van Beethoven celebrating 40 years of telephone free landslide victory, their debut record. It's a long time. So these shows are Camper's first live performances in 5 years. Is it like riding a bicycle, getting back and doing live shows with these guys?
Yeah, more or less. I mean, we did rehearse. I was actually just adding this up. You know, we haven't played since before COVID. Camper Van Beethoven hasn't played together. Cracker's played. I've played plenty of shows. Everybody's played individually, but we haven't played a Camper Van Beethoven show since like January 21st, 2020. And so, you know, it took some practicing. I was just adding it up. I actually practiced for more than 40 hours before this show, and everybody else did pretty much the same. And it's still probably going to be a little bit, you know, we'll be winging some parts of it a little bit. I'm excited about doing these shows. And like I said, probably put about 40 something hours into getting ready for this show.
I mean, I get the feeling that these shows are going to be a celebration of the band. They're more than just let's get together for the anniversary. Is that you feeling that?
Yeah. And, we brought back some of the, we have some of the original players joining us that weren't really in the touring band very much. We have Chris Mola joining us with the show. And we also have Anthony Guess on a couple songs. He was actually the drummer who played on the first album. And we didn't really know where he was, but he tracked us down. And so he's going to play on a couple songs too. So I'm sort of excited by all this. Yeah, it's a homecoming of sorts. As I don't know if you know this, but Camper is like spread over 5 time zones on 3 different continents. So we don't see each other very often.
Gotcha. So your dad was in the Air Force. You moved around a bit before you guys settled in Redlands. So tell me about Redlands. What was going on there in the early 80s, and how did it affect the attitude and the sound and the approach of what became Camper Van Beethoven?
Well, we were, at that time, that area of California was distinct from Los Angeles. It wasn't part of the sprawling suburbia. Like, there was actually kind of an area of orchards and vineyards and dairy farming and ranching that you went through when you drove from Los Angeles out to Redlands. Now it's pretty much solid suburbia all the way there. And it was a little bit of a distinct area compared to Los Angeles. I mean, we were sort of the suburbs, but like my high school had a cowboy clique. You know what I mean? Guys in cowboy hats with cowboy boots that chewed tobacco, you know, and they hung out at one end of the parking lot, right? It was a little more like the Central Valley or the, you know, ranching regions of California. It was a little different. So we had a sort of an eclectic mix. I mean, we did have Los Angeles radio. We heard punk rock. There were punk rock bands. But, you know, we were also just as much as informed by like kind of country music, for lack of a better word, or sort of more rootsier music and stuff like that. There was a lot of that around. That's sort of how the Camper Van Beethoven sound is, you know, sort of informed. That's how like all this other stuff gets sort of mixed up in there. Jonathan Sagal, you know, who later joined Camper when we moved to Santa Cruz, he was from Davis, California, which is in the Central Valley. And yes, it's where one of the University of California campuses is, but that is farm country too. And, you know, he kind of had the same sort of growing up experience that we did, although he had more of the Northern California hippie vibe in his growing up. And we're very much a product of where we're from.
Yeah. I saw Camper Van Beethoven many times, and I thought they were sort of a transcendent live band. Like many of my favorite bands, they were, and you're a math guy, I think you can appreciate this, they were like kind of chemistry. Like the sum of the parts equaled more than the sum on paper, you know. And I would recommend their shows to anyone who liked music. You know, there's very few bands that I would say, if you've never heard a note of their music, still go see this band. As long as you like music, you will like it. I assume you agree with that theory. And if you do, can you give me a reason why you think that happened?
Well, I think everybody in their own right was a writer and sort of maybe a leader of their own bands. Like, see, Camper Van Beethoven was actually kind of this weird side project where we were all playing not our main instrument. Like, I was the bass player in everybody's band, right? I was kind of the good bass player in Redlands and then Santa Cruz, right? And I played for other people. And Jonathan was a guitar player, played a lot of more jammier sort of Grateful Dead stuff, and he was learning the violin. So what that was us playing different instruments, but we're like kind of you know, featured performers basically in other bands. So when we got together, you know, I mean, I always said it, you know, it was like a 10 pounds of guitar riffs in a 5-pound bag, sort of playing on a vulgar expression. But that's kind of what it was. So there was never a shortage of musical riffs. It was the trick with Camper Van Beethoven was just tying it together into a coherent song. And then sometimes not even that, just like it's, you know, it's not a coherent song, and that's kind of the charm of it, right?
Yeah. Interesting. I assume there is a downside to having a band of only leaders.
Well, yeah. I mean, it made it so, you know, it was an unwieldy process if you consider the fact we were like some sort of an anarcho-syndicalist commune which we had to decide everything by consensus. So it was difficult to get things decided sometimes and stuff like that. And it made the band somewhat unstable, but I don't know. We figured it out, at least in our second incarnation.
Yeah, I guess that's the price to pay for that kind of level of creativity. So when you went to record your early records like Telephone, Free Landslide, Victory, did you just try to capture that chemistry, or did you acknowledge the idea of crafting something different to make a record?
Those first few albums are pretty much what we played live, you know what I mean? Not totally. There's some studio experiments and stuff in there, but and especially the first album was, we pretty much just did that live in the studio and then overdubbed the percussion and the vocals. So that's like how we played. We were a band that rehearsed a lot and worked stuff out. Later we became sort of more of a studio project, and, you know, kind of, but even like the first major label album, Our Beloved Revolutionary Sweetheart, we could play that whole album, like all those parts, we could play that live. It wasn't until really Key Lime Pie that it was developed more in the studio.
I read that within 18 months of releasing that first record, you guys were playing arenas with REM. So I'm going to, I looked at the math. I think you're like 24, maybe 25 when this is happening. Was everyone's minds blowing? Were you guys mentally prepared for this? Was it, you know, was it all good? Was it not all good?
Genuinely, it happened so fast. I think I'm the oldest one in the band. No, maybe Chris Peterson's my age. I mean, Chris Peterson's a little bit older than me. But I think I was actually like 26 by the time we were playing with REM. But yeah, we were young people suddenly, like, going from, you know, really quickly going from playing like basically house parties to playing like decent sized venues and stuff like that, like really quickly. I remember here's a moment that was, for us, it was like really interesting. We started a cross country on sort of our first cross country tour in like late January, early February of 1986, and at the beginning of the tour, I mean, like, well, maybe not in Los Angeles where people did kind of know us, but at the beginning of the tour we were playing for like 25 or 30 people, and then sort of for some reason by the time we get to Detroit, or maybe it was actually Ann Arbor, we're on the radio, and like we had to do 3 shows. There were so many tickets. We were like at the Blind Pig, I think is the name of the venue. I think it's still there. It's like maybe like a 400 capacity room. We had to do 3 shows. There was so much demand for our tickets. So that's about 2.5 weeks later. That was like wild.
Yeah, that's right? Super exciting.
It's because like Detroit radio was playing us. And so as we were on that tour, you know, it just kind of blew up, right? And maybe not everywhere, but it, you know, like you know, we were selling out shows like before we got to the, you know, before we even got to the East Coast.
Yeah, totally amazing. I assume that's what you guys all wanted to happen. And I guess the end result of this, you know, after a couple of self-produced records, is that you get signed to Virgin. And I'm curious, like, what happened in that room? And again, on the new album, there are some songs that sort of explore all of this. Like, what did they tell you? We love exactly what you're doing. Keep doing it. Or did they say, you know, we're going to help you smooth out the rough edges? Or what was the idea artistically?
Virgin Records was really pretty cool to us. And actually, I mean, you hear a lot of horror stories about record labels because nobody ever tells, like, sort of the good, like, this isn't a story. Oh yeah, we were just kind of left alone and we made that record, right? That's not really a story that anybody else is, you know, that's going to get passed around.
Sure, I got paid my royalties is not a story.
Yeah, those are the ones that get passed around, right? And so our experience with Virgin was they, you know, they sort of come around looking for signing us maybe a couple records before that or some interest in us. And so by the time we do sign with them, we're kind of ready to sign with them. And literally at some point, I say this actually in a song about Cracker, but it was actually probably earlier. It was probably in the Camper era. There was like at some point, like I just sort of get face to face with the record company president at that time. His name's Jeff Aroff. And I'm sort of explaining, you know, so what we're trying to do for the record and stuff like that. And he's not actually dismissive, but he's just like, oh, young ones, look, just write a bunch of songs. One of them will be a hit. You know, like, I mean, that was kind of the attitude that, I mean, we didn't really have the sort of horrible major label-like experience until, at least I didn't, until, like, much, much later in my career, you know, and stuff. So,
were you guys ambitious?
I was. I think to a certain extent, there were varying degrees of ambition. You know, Greg Leischer, you know, the lead guitarist, was always musing about just, you know, quitting and going back to school to learn to play jazz. You know, varying degrees of ambition among members of the band. You know, I think, you know, sometimes that was like a real bit of tension because I was like, yeah, let's go to Europe, let's promote this record and stuff like that. And not everybody was into it. Not everybody was into going on tour or being away from home and stuff like that. So, you know, that was an issue at times.
You guys were sort of the textbook indie band, you know what I mean? Literally, the, you know, and then sort of, so it is interesting to like sign the deal with like, you know, the alleged devil. So our beloved Revolutionary Sweetheart, 1988, a record I really love, and I think it just kind of brought out parts of the band that were there, but just the way the record sounds, the just the whole way it's arranged, it definitely sounds like you guys, but it's definitely a huge step forward. You worked with Dennis Hearing, like kind of like the first real producer for you guys. How different was that recording process? And, you know, I think it was just like right place, right time for that record. And do you like the way that record holds up?
I do, although Key Lime Pie sounds so cool compared to our beloved Revolutionary Sweetheart. I think there are in some ways you can kind of like, okay, so we're kind of playing with the modern rock, sort of a bigger rock sound. We're going from indie rock, like, well, let's go in a studio and let's actually put some reverb on the drums. You know what I mean? Put some gated reverb on the drums. Let's make the drums like more like, you know, like more of a hard rock band would make the drum sound or something like that. We're playing with that. And we're trying to make it not sound indie, but also be pretty screwed up and weird in some way. So we're like, you know, the snare is big. It's got the gated snare on it, like you had in the 80s, right? Like something that we wouldn't have necessarily done with the indie records before that. But we're kind of playing with that big rock studio album vibe, or what amounted to that. That's why, you know, we also have the songs on it that are in a way like almost like Led Zeppelin songs, like Aya Fatima Part 2 or Waka, right? That's why we have, you know, tracks like that on that record, right? We're trying to grow out of like indie college rock into something else. But it's also pretty weird too, right? You know, so you have the elements of like sort of that 80s rock studio sound, but I mean, just the songs are really not like the stuff that was on the radio then, you know what I mean? So that's kind of what we're doing there.
You guys kind of had an interesting place in that. I think you're always going to have some fans who would rather be unhappy than happy. You know, they'd always rather say, well, I liked them before they sold out or before they were famous or before they put gated reverb on the drums. There's all those people who, and then there's other fans who grow with you and just accept whatever you do. And they want to hear it, you know, because it's you, as long as it's sincere, which I think everything you guys did was, at least I think. Did you worry about alienating people, or did you just say, this is what we're doing and not even think about it?
I think, you know, in those days in the 80s, people overthought everything, especially in the rock music thing. I think we did worry about that sometimes. I mean, that's partly why Pictures of Matchstick Men isn't on our beloved Revolutionary Sweetheart, although we recorded it for that album. We're like, maybe we shouldn't have a cover, you know, on our first major label record. That'll be the one that the label will do as a single and stuff like that. But by the time we get to Key Lime Pie, we're like, first of all, we end up re-recording that song for Key Lime Pie so it matches, because the original recording didn't match. The Key Lime Pie is just recorded. It's like on a different level, the recording of that. And it's tracked in the main Capitol room where like Beach Boys records, Frank Sinatra's records were recorded, right? You know, it's just kind of on another level. But by the time we get to Key Lime Pie, I don't think we don't care about that as much. But we definitely thought about it. Thought about people thinking that we sold out and stuff like that with the first major label record for Camper Van Beethoven.
Until Key Lime Pie, I think, if I've got it right, correct me, there really aren't individual song credits. Songs, there's almost no credits, so there's no clue as to who wrote the songs, which I assume is a hint that they were collaborative efforts. And I'm wondering, was that just like an agreement, sort of like Lennon-McCartney, or was it how bands were, you know, all the songs were worked up in jams, or did people come in with bits, or did some people write 80% of a song, but we decide, you know, we'll just all share? How did that work?
It was all over the place. Some would be completely written by one individual, or a big chunk of it would be written by somebody. Some of them were just totally collaborative in the studio. So yeah, that's why we didn't really, it was more like the Paul McCartney, you know, McCartney Lennon thing is like, we'll just sort of list it as Camper Van Beethoven. And worry about it later. I think the reason we kind of really list it later is I'm not really sure why we listed it later, but I thought maybe it had to do with like we had to list outside writers or people who weren't necessarily in Camper Van Beethoven anymore. I don't remember. It was something to do with that. So,
but you guys always shared the publishing?
We largely shared the publishing. There were a couple songs that came in to Camper Van Beethoven that I wrote with other bands, so obviously we didn't share on that, but we tried to as best we could. Yeah, absolutely.
I think bands who do that usually think it keeps the band together for longer than your average band together span.
Yeah, that was the theory. So, but it didn't, you know, Camper breaks up in 1990, right? It didn't really help us. So by the time I get in Cracker, I'm just like, we're going to share a little bit of the writing. We're going to share the writing a little bit, but we're going to kind of do it more. Like Johnny would get credited in Cracker. Johnny got credited on songs, even if like I wrote the whole thing, but the percentages were split in a way that, like, if I wrote the song, I got like the lion's share of the songwriting. 'Cause there's a certain amount of that, of if you decide to just split the royalties among the band members, that can help the band stay together in a lot of ways. And it makes it so like you put the best songs on a record instead of like, oh, well, we've got to have a song by this person and right. have a song by this person on it. Right. That's what the idea of doing that is. But at the same time, sometimes you get a dynamic where people don't contribute to the songwriting. I'm not saying that this happened necessarily with Camper, but this is what happens with bands just over the years. I've seen this happen where people stop really contributing to the songwriting. And then, like, you know, it usually ends up with two people. Most bands usually have two main writers. I don't know why that is, but two people kind of end up doing all the writing. And that takes time. You know what I mean? Like, you know, if you're going to make a record, you know, you're going to try to record a record in June of a year, you probably want to start the songwriting process in January, start coming up with the songs, right? Mm. It's not like you just sort of sit down with a candle at your desk and a quill pen and a glass of wine and write a song that evening, you know, with your acoustic guitar. It's a weird process, and it involves like a lot of dead ends and making up little riffs and little proto songs and, you know, that never go anywhere and stuff like that, and reimagining things that are seem like they're songs that are good, and then there's something wrong with them and you have to reimagine them, and you might reimagine them in three or four different ways. There's a lot of work that goes into the songwriting. So usually what happens is after a while, even though you're, you know, you might be splitting the songwriting, at some point there's just sort of an irresistible sort of urge to eventually kind of split up the songs more according to who really worked on them.
Yeah. That's a good opportunity for me to remind folks that David Lowery is our guest. Brand new album is called Father, Sons, and Brothers, comes out May 30th and has 28 tracks on it. So lots of songs.
Yeah, it's a 2-hour, 3-LP, 2-CD set that is in lieu of an autobiography, I guess is what it is.
Folks can go to David Lowery Music, CamperVanBeethoven.com, CrackerSoul.com. You've got a lot of web presence. So after Key Lime Pie in 1998, the band goes on for a little while longer and then breaks up. You know, in a nutshell, why break up?
Oh, well, I think, you know, definitely one of the things was, is that I was driving everybody to tour probably way more than they really wanted to or were capable of. So we were kind of on this grueling. We'd been on tours basically since August of 1989, when the band breaks up in April of 1990. We'd basically been on tour that whole time, right? And I was also going through a bunch of stuff. Like, I broke up with my longtime girlfriend. That's chronicled on the solo record. And also, there is a song called Europass, which sort of chronicles the end of that tour into a song called We Hate You, which is just literally what I was told one morning at breakfast when, you know, right before the band broke up.
You were told that by other members of the band?
Yes. Yes. And so this is chronicled, and it's not, it's, I mean, the song is titled We Hate You. It's intended to be funny and outrageous that I call the song that. And, you know, because kind of tells the story that yeah. way. So that's where the band breaks up. But, you know, there's a lot going on at that point because, for one, Key Lime Pie in retrospect is really well regarded by critics and fans of the band and stuff like that. But commercially, it was kind of a little bit of a letdown. Like, Camper was always on the sort of the verge of breaking through, but never really sort of breaking through. I mean, obviously, we had some great markets. We could always go to Seattle and sell at the Moore Theater. And we could sell at the Fillmore in San Francisco. You know, people really loved us in Austin, Texas, and stuff like that. But the band was never really breaking through. And it's almost like, I think, like, the band almost feels like I let everybody down a dead end with Key Lime Pie, which is really kind of different from the previous records. It's not got the sort of sardonic, sort of lighter, more humorous feel to it.
Yeah.
It's a pretty dark record. And it's like, yeah, you know, like, you know, you're you're grinding us down, you know. You're being a jerk to us, and we're going down a dead end. F*** this, right?
We hate you.
Yeah, we hate you.
Yeah. Okay, so there's a song called Leaving Key Member Clause on your new record. And I guess what this record is about is how in this contract you signed with Virgin, after Camper breaks up, they're like, whoa, not so fast. You can't just walk away. We actually... You know, read the contract carefully. We can actually just say, hey, David, you've got to stay with us. But that sort of makes you start Cracker, and it's the song's very interesting. There's another song called It Didn't Last Long, which is sort of about what happens in Cracker. Help me put Cracker in context of sort of 90s rock and of, like, you know, CD mania, and, you know, there was, like, you know, fuzz pedals and Nirvana. There was a lot going on there, and Cracker fits into that. How do you see that?
It fits in accidentally to it.
Yeah.
So, like, Cracker, so we have the same A&R person, and just going back to Leaving Key Member Clause, a lot of people, or some people in Camper, were a little bummed that I got the contract. You know, but sort of not realizing what goes along with that is like, well, also you sort of get some of the, you don't get all of the debt, but you get some of the debt, and you don't really get to negotiate a new contract. You're under the terms of the old contract. And when you're the Leaving Key Member, a lot of the terms of that contract get ratcheted down because you're more of a risk now. So it's a little, there's some mixed, it's a mixed blessing that I am sort of, I get picked up as the Leaving Key Member, and I now have a recording contract, but I also have to sort of, you know, get some songs, put a band together and stuff like that. And it ends up being a great experience. The band ends up being successful, like with the first song on the first album we make, it's on MTV, like before the album's even out. But it wasn't obvious that it was going to be successful because, as you remember, the 90s, a lot of fuzz pedal, a lot of grunge and stuff like that. But really, the first two Cracker records are pretty Americana, country rock, roots rock, blues rock, southern rock. I don't know how to describe it, but it's way more roots rock than Camper Van Beethoven was. And the biggest thing on the radio at that time is grunge. Like, all the radio stations that played Camper Van Beethoven are now basically playing grunge. Well, as it turns out, like, our songs they're rock enough to fit into the format. So, and then Low is kind of weirdly a kind of grungy kind of song. But those are Americana albums, really, ultimately, those first two. And at the time, when we turned in the first record to our A&R guy, it's the same guy who did Camper Van Beethoven. It's very, he's very hands-off with us, very supportive of us. And he sits me down, and he basically says this, look, this is a cool record. I like it. It's basically, though, a country rock record, and grunge is the biggest thing in the country. So we can put this out. It'll sell 60,000 copies, maybe 100,000 copies, right? But it's not, it's just, it's sort of weirdly out of step with the times, right? But somehow it ends up being, you know, ends up having it. We have a single on the first record. It's a kind of a big, heavy rotation MTV hit. And then the second album has three songs on it. And it's kind of absurd because he's right that, I mean, Eurotrash Girl is an 8 minute long, it's a country rock song if you listen to it. And it's 8 minutes long, and it's somehow implausibly played on modern rock radio alongside all of this grunge stuff, right? And harder alternative rock stuff. So he's right in a way what he says about the style, but somehow we got played in the format, and it worked out for us. And that's, you know, basically like a platinum record.
Yeah, Cracker has two platinum and two gold albums. I mean, it's a huge man. And by the way, still together, right? What is it, 35 years or something? And you've got a new sort of a there's a whole story about why this record came together, but it's sort of a career retrospective, but sort of a backdoor sort of retrospective. But it's really interesting. Lots of different versions of some songs, including like a more bluegrass version of Eurotrash Girl.
That's right. Yeah. So you're talking about the alternative history of Cracker, which is sort of the thing we put out in, I guess, late November, which is all alternate takes of kind of, it's a history of Cracker, but it's told with alternate takes. I would say it was my idea, but it kind of wasn't really. It was just what we had available to license. So it just sort of fell together. Yeah.
Yeah. So what would have happened had Camper Van Beethoven made the song Low for whatever the follow-up to Key Lime Pie had been? Would it have blown up?
I don't know if we would have recorded it the same. The Camper Van Beethoven the song would have been a lot more complicated. So I don't know if there's something about the simplicity of the song that makes that song a hit.
That's very interesting.
Now, Camper could have made Eurotrash Girl.
Yeah.
And Camper was, you know, one of the things I'm always looking at why things happen. And a lot of times the reason that things happen is less to do with like your own personal skill. It's just like things changed and you were in the right place at the right time. So I think actually, so when Camper Van Beethoven's putting out records and pictures of Matchstick Men's getting played on modern rock radio in the United States, there's about 40 of those radio stations in the United States. By the time Cracker puts out a record, there's like 150 or 200 of those modern rock radio stations in the United States. So Cracker was just going to be bigger. So if Camper had made a record after Key Lime Pie, it would have just been bigger. I mean, it may have gone gold or something like that, just because the audience was, there was this radio world that was there, that was barely there for Camper, that was there for Cracker, right? Mm-hmm. Some of it was just like the culture just changing and commercial radio changing and things like that, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's interesting.
You know, Camper would have been invited on the Lollapalooza tour. It just would have, you know what I mean? It would have been bigger.
Yeah, but I guess what was gone, or at least starting to degrade by that point, was kind of that more organic world of zines and college radio and things that were able to start bands like Camper. That kind of...
Oh, no. Yeah, exactly. But that world that Camper grew out of was dying, but we would have just been plugged into the machine.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? It just would, you know, partly because, you know, just like I said, we were just kind of, Yeah, we were there at that time, right? Well, we weren't there at that time, but we would have been in the same spot that Cracker was in.
Yeah. So new album, Father, Sons, and Brothers, May 28th, 28 tracks. There are, we talked about this. This is a sort of an autobiography, but in song. There's songs about, you know, girls and family and music and being in bands and music business and all kinds of stuff. One of the songs that caught my ear was a song about being in Disneyland jail. And it brings up drugs and alcohol. And I think in this record, you talk a little bit about recovery. And I don't know how, you know, perfectly autobiographical this is. So are you a person in recovery?
I'm a sober person. Yes. I don't, I would say I'm in recovery, but you know, I've been sober for like 20 years, coming up on 20 years now. So sometimes I don't really talk like that anymore, but I did at one point talk about that a lot and use a lot of that language and stuff like that. And there's a song called Vending Machine, which is really specifically about getting sober. It's about me being in charge of the vending machine at the AA room that I used to go to and the people there.
Well, I thought that in the song you sort of say, like, instead of using higher power, David, you just substitute the phrase vending machine.
Well, because I couldn't answer the question do you believe in God? And also too, what's sort of, it's also in the song, is it was like basically a historically black AA room. It wasn't totally black anymore, and it was right behind my studio. It's just kind of the place I wandered into, and the first question was like, do you believe in God? And I was like, I couldn't answer the question right to them, so they go, all right, your higher power is the vending machine. It's like, okay, this is totally weird. But I came to understand over the years of going to meetings in that room is they did that on purpose to people who couldn't answer the question. So everybody knew who couldn't answer the question in the meetings, because if the vending machine was your higher power, your job was to unplug it when the meeting started. And when the meeting ended, you had to go back over and plug it in.
Well, that's great. So it's just them saddling you with a little extra chore.
Like, it's pretty hilarious, right? Yeah. So, yeah, I talk a lot about drinking and drugs and the destructive impact and stuff like that through the album. It's not the only thing I talk about in the album.
No.
I also talk about, like, you know, other kind of, you know, there's a sort of generational sort of injury that goes through my family, I think, because my father's brother was murdered in a murder suicide, and it's the story is told in the song, and there's a lot of stuff in this record that's for me needed to be told, needed to come out, needed to tell the story. You know, I want to tell my grandfather's story of being in World War II, you know, in this song. A lot of it's me needing to tell other people's stories that their stories would have gone and told as well, too.
But you do a great job of sort of telling the stories in a real straightforward way, but keeping it, you know, they're melodic and tuneful, and, you know, it's not just like a guy reading his autobiography while some music plays in the background. You know, it still is a pop record album. I need to get back to Disneyland Jail because I love Disneyland.
Okay, so Disneyland Jail is a true story. That's me and my friend Dale Miller. We go to Disneyland on one of those. Can you imagine those nights where they let basically, they'd keep Disneyland open all night for high school kids or whatever like that. And it was sort of semi-chaperoned, but not really. And, you know, we basically get drunk and take mushrooms. And I managed to play it cool, Dale not so much. And so, like, the undercover security at Disneyland picked up on Dale. And he ends up being taken to Disneyland jail. And basically, you know, kind of all they did in those days was just like, you kids just hang out here until you kind of sober up, and then we're going to let you go. Oh. You know what I mean? It was sort of like, you know, it's just kind of like a holding area or whatever.
Gotcha.
So that's where they sent us.
Kind of a badge of honor, though.
It was kind of a badge of honor, yes. You know, everybody at school heard about the fact that we did this and that had happened to us, and we were kind of somehow some sort of heroes because of this. But partly what that song does two things, though. It tells that story, but the other thing is it's a cautionary tale for my sons, which I'm like, please just take the straight and narrow, like stay in the chess club, like keep playing clarinet in marching band, like please take the straight and narrow, because we could have easily, like, we did so many crazy things when we were a kid, we could have died so many times.
I want to turn a corner now. You know, as if playing in Camper and Cracker and doing a solo thing isn't enough, you also do teaching. You're a senior lecturer in the music business certification program at the University of Georgia in Athens, and you are very outspoken for artist rights in the digital age. You do a lot of writing at a website called The Tricordist, and I recommend folks check it out if you're interested in that topic. This is a huge thing. We could do an hour on this easily. I know that you've testified before Congress a couple times. You've written some very influential and widely read articles on the subject, and you've helped put together lawsuits that help artists maybe get fair compensation. So I got really two questions here. The one big question is, what can folks do to actually move the needle towards making this issue more fair for compensation for streaming music for artists?
Well, the biggest thing is to listen on a subscription platform and not on the free platforms, because we get a percentage of the revenue, and the free platforms don't really generate revenue, so we get a percentage of nothing, basically. So if you have a subscription, if you have like an Apple Music subscription, that pays like, well, it's the some of the services got a little better, but the Apple, of the major platforms, Apple generally pays the highest. Spotify is kind of somewhere in the middle, and YouTube's always at the bottom. So maybe listen on Apple Music and not on YouTube if you can avoid it. And that makes a huge difference. Like literally like 5 or 6 times as much revenue flows to us if you listen on something like Apple Music. That's one of the things. But the other thing is just buying the physical albums. I mean, it still just pays so much more than streaming does.
Yeah, I think one of your articles talks about how you made more from selling a t-shirt than you did from a million streams of Low, I think it's Cracker song. So who is pushing back against fair compensation for artists? Is there anyone besides who we would think, the usual characters, the people that own and want to keep the money for themselves?
In general, every digital platform has the same DNA, with the exception of maybe Apple, because they sell handsets. But they all have the same DNA, which is let's pay as little as possible to the people who make the product, right? That's just the way they're set up. Every time a new platform is launched, they're like, we're not paying for music. I mean, TikTok pays the worst, and they pay so little. They're such an inconsequential portion of the revenue of the music business. Like, I don't know, it's in the single digit percentage. Like, I don't know if it's 4% or something like that, but it's way down there. But yet TikTok is the most popular media platform in the world, right? And it's just such a tiny, and it's all based on music, and it's just a tiny portion of revenue that goes to the people who made the music, right? It's just really disgusting. It just seems like every single time a new platform launches, they start out as, we're not going to pay anything, right? I'm just really surprised there hasn't been a, like, I led those class actions. I don't do that anymore. I don't do any civil lawsuits. I'm waiting for somebody to file a criminal white-collar RICO case against some of these platforms. It needs to be done, right? Wow.
All right, let's turn the corner one more time. You've got a ton. It's going to be a very busy summer. There are a lot of David Lowery solo gigs. There are some Cracker gigs. There are some Camper Van Beethoven gigs. And once again, folks can go to davidlowerymusic.com, campervanbeethoven.com, campersoul.com. I noticed one thing. You've got a Cracker date with, I think it's opening for Big Head Todd and the Monsters, a band who I don't know at all, but I noticed that Cheap Trick is on the bill. Is that like, I mean, I don't know if you like Cheap Trick. I love them. Is that an exciting thing for you still at this point in your career? Wow, I get to be on a bill with Cheap Trick. And because I think we don't really know what it's like to pull into Red Rocks Amphitheater and, you know, be backstage. Like, is it a situation where you never see Cheap Trick, you know, or is it a chance where you're...
Oh, no, well... Yeah, we'll see Cheap Trick. And actually, we've played with them before and kind of know them through my wife who's a concert promoter. And so Big Head Todd is a Denver band. That is their hometown show that they do, I think, every summer about that time. They do two nights there. Big Head Todd is a great band, and this is their hometown show. This is a big deal show. And so we're on the Friday night, and the guests on the Friday night are Cheap Trick and us. It's a great place to play. It's beautiful. It's a place that the Beatles played, you know what I mean? So it's a magical sort of environment to play in. So I'm definitely looking forward to it. We've played with Big Head Todd quite a lot, so I'm pretty good friends with them. So yes, we all will be hanging around backstage together, I would imagine.
That's nice to think about. So new album, Father, Sons, and Brothers. You mentioned a 3 LP, and that vinyl is expensive, with a gatefold sleeve and a 12-page booklet, a 2-CD set with a 20-page booklet, and of course, streaming everywhere. So, you know, I was listening to all these songs, and there's, as we talked about earlier, dysfunctional family and just tough times and romance and business and being in bands. And I sort of draw the conclusion, and correct me if I'm wrong, that you are relatively happy and well-adjusted. If that's right, is there a secret to that outcome?
I sort of say this in the liner note, you know, have the liner notes on the record, is that one of the things I say is like, one of the reasons, like, people have urged me is like, hey, write an autobiography, you know, because a lot, that's what you kind of do when you're at my age and you've been in two successful bands, kind of have a solo career, you've done all these things. It's just like, you know, you're primed for an autobiography. But rock autobiographies sort of have a sort of formula to them when they work really well. And I don't have that formula. I got lucky, like, at every turn. Camper Van Beethoven makes an album. We record it for $500. My cousin tells me how to send it to the BBC. And so we send it to the BBC, and it gets played, like, right away, you know, on an indie record. Cracker's first album comes out, and it's like the first song on the first album is like an MTV hit. Like, at every turn, I never really struggled. My parents were supportive of of my music. I didn't have to overcome resistance from, you know, my family. You know, like, I just don't have all of those little cliched things that you have to overcome to get to where you're going as an artist. You have to struggle and you fight and you overcome and stuff like that. I don't really have that. So to write a sort of autobiography, like rock autobiography, I had to do it a totally different way because, yeah, I mean, like, I think I struggle at some points with stuff like that, but I just, like, I didn't really have any hurdles to overcome. I came to a hurdle and I jumped over it the first time. It's sort of lacking some of the classic, like, dramatic tension that goes in your basic rock autobiography. So this, just some people, you know, who've been listening to this, is like, hey man, this whole thing is really earnest. Right? It's like not what I expected. Like, you, like, And then, you know, some of it's like sad. There's like bad things that happen and stuff like that. But the whole thing is really super earnest. It's almost like conservative, small c conservative on some level, where it is about family and like, you know, sort of, and, you know, paying tribute to your friends and the people that helped you and being like really thankful and stuff like that, you know. And then the whole thing's called Father, Sons, and Brothers because it's kind of about, a lot of it's about the sort of the men in the family, not just the men. I had three sisters and my mother was a wonderful person and stuff like that. But a lot of it's about kind of the foibles of like all the men while the women are kind of holding down the fort.
Yeah. Let's get out of here with, I wrote a song called Take the Skinheads Bowling. Just what a fantastic kind of sequel almost, or follow-up song.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of outrageous like to write a follow-up to Take the Skinheads Bowling about writing the song and basically copying the chorus, sort of, although it's sung totally differently. It's quoted in there. But yeah, so that the point of I wrote a song called Take the Skinheads Bowling was I actually started the band with this guy named David McDaniel. He was named the band Camper Van Beethoven. And he, you know, like for instance, co-wrote the song Lassie Goes to the Moon. He wrote a couple of the, you know, songs that people really love on the first Camper Van Beethoven record. And he's nowhere in the history because he was in the band for about 3 months. And one day he's like, hey, I'm not going to move to Santa Cruz with you guys because I think I found what I want to do in my life. And I've had a calling from God. And so I'm going to go and become a minister and I'm going to go and help people. Right. Also not a very rock story. Right. So I basically tell that story in the song. I wrote a song called Take the Skinheads Bowling. I just tell that story. And again, it's a super earnest song. I mean, it's not, I think it's sweet. It's a little bit funny and stuff like that, but it's a very earnest song. And I think a lot of people didn't expect that. That's like what the tone of this album is compared to my past catalog in a way.
Yeah. Oh, and that guy could have just worshipped vending machines and he'd still be with... in the band today. It's just,
yeah, he could have been a vending machine worshiper, so yeah, and he'd still be in the band. That's right.
Well, thank you so much. It's such a fascinating story, and I do feel like we just kind of got the tip of the iceberg. But the new album, once again, is Father, Sons, and Brothers. DavidLowryMusic.com, I think, is probably the main place to go for that. And I know you got the big show tonight and you probably have to go to sound check. So I will let you go, but you know, best of luck with everything and let's hear the song. And thanks for visiting with us.
Okay. Thank you. No problem. Thank you.
Reverend McDaniel built an orphanage. sadly, you've never heard of him, and you barely heard